Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now, novelist Michael Chabon asked the question, what if, in the setting of his new novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, what if Harold Dickey's idea to settle Jews fleeing Europe in Alaska had been approved? What if the Jews lost the war in 1948 and Israel was never established? What if Yiddish were the language of this temporary Jewish refuge in Alaska that's now to be given back to the state of Alaska on January 1st, 2008? That is some of the alternate history of a Jewish homeland in which the murder mystery at the heart of the novel takes place. Yes, it's an alternative history of the Jews and a murder mystery. Michael Chabon's previous books include The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, remember that, for which he won the 2001 Pulitzer Prize, and Wonder Boys, which was made into a movie starring Michael Douglas. He joins us now to talk about playing around with some of history's pivot points. And, oh, by the way, as we mentioned earlier, the Yiddish Policeman's Union is one of the thank you gifts in this drive, available with a $120 pledge. Michael, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you? It's great to be here, Brian.
Did I catch all the main what-ifs?
It sounds mashuga when you start putting it all together like that.
Is it mashuga?
I think it might be.
You know, Scott Simon interviewed...
What was I thinking?
Go ahead.
You hit them all. That's a lot of what-ifs, but... I think you didn't miss any.
So Scott Simon interviewed a historian last weekend about Icky's plan, which was real back in the 1940s. But in your book, a timely car accident changes the course of history. Explain that a little bit.
That's right. Well, I did hear the interview that Scott Simon conducted, and the scholar that he was talking to identified one of the culprits responsible for quashing this proposal, really strangling it in its cradle before it ever had a chance to come to fruition, as Gruning, who went on to become the first governor of the state of Alaska when Alaska got statehood. But there was another guy, Anthony Diamond, who was the delegate to Congress from the territory of Alaska, and he was vehemently opposed to this proposal, and he was at least as responsible for quashing it. And in my novel, he is coming out of Hogate's Seafood Restaurant in Washington, D.C., a place that was legendary for its rum buns. And I guess he was taking a few home for his kids or his wife, and he drops one and chases it into the street and is run over by a taxi cab and killed, and therefore... he's not there to sort of help galvanize and focus the opposition.
Yeah, so the main opponent to that plan dies in the book, and therefore it goes forward. Can you talk?
All because of a rum bun.
I hope it was a really good rum bun.
They were good. I remember. I grew up in D.C. I remember being rather fond of them myself.
The history is probably not even familiar to many of our Jewish listeners. Do you want to talk about it a little bit? What was this proposal?
Well, you bet. You know, it's funny. It's not even familiar. Not only is it not familiar to, you know, most people down here, but in Alaska, it's also now very little known. And I was up in Sitka, and I did encounter a few people, Jews who live up there in Sitka, who had heard about it, but most of them had not heard about it either. It's you know, it's all but forgotten. But it was an attempt by Harold Ickes, who was genuinely motivated by humanitarian concern for the plight of the refugees in Europe and the Jews who wanted to get out of Hitler's Europe. And in that regard, he was pretty unique in the Roosevelt administration. But he couched his proposal to let refugees into the United States in very pragmatic terms of exploiting Alaskan resources, that there was this huge untapped wealth up there in Alaska, and there were very few people living there to tap it, and that this was going to be this really clever way of forcing migration into Alaska, a place that not there many people really wanted to go.
So freeing the Jews from the Holocaust and cheap immigrant labor
exactly
met in the middle on that proposal.
Exactly. And killing two birds with one stone, exactly.
Now,
it in a way, maybe the disingenuity of not admitting that what you were doing, because there was in these proposals and in the legislation that was introduced into Congress and in the Slattery report, which is the report that was issued by the Interior Department that kind of got this whole thing going. You know, I don't think the word Jew makes a single appearance, they were very circumspect, but maybe that circumspection kind of created an atmosphere of bad faith around the proposal that aggravated the opposition to it. I don't know.
Novelist Michael Chabon, my guest on WNYC. His new book is The Yiddish Policeman's Union, which takes place in this alternative history Alaska. And I read that you started with the question of language, and what if there was really a place where a Yiddish phrase book for travelers would be necessary, something you wrote an essay about years ago that stuck with you?
That's right. I mean, there is such a book. It's a wonderful little book called Say It in Yiddish, and it's part of a series of the Say It books that are published by Dover, and they're Say It in French and Say It in Italian and Say It in German and Say It in Swahili.
And they're for travelers, but there's nowhere in the world where Yiddish is the local language.
That's right, and that's why the book struck me so forcefully when I first came upon it. I almost couldn't believe it was real. I thought it might be a joke or a hoax or something, and you know, because it's so deadpan, it's so sincere, it's not meant humorously at all. That made it seem all the more suspect. But in fact, it was an authentic attempt by its authors to create a working, useful phrase book that you could take to a place where, you know, the entire administrative and bureaucratic structure and all of the institutions, as well as presumably all of the people living there, were Yiddish speaking. And, you know, the only problem that I could see with this phrase book is that there isn't any such place. But I had this impulse to start trying to imagine the places, possible places where you might have been able to take a Yiddish phrase book if things had worked out slightly differently.
And so you have jokes in here that would be most funny to Yiddish speakers. And I gather you're going to read a section for us that has something to do with that?
Sure. Well, I have...
I think you were going to read from page 2. Is that it?
Yeah, that one is more about my character, Lantzman, the main character, the homicide detective, who's the...
Either way.
The hero of the book.
Either way, that, or if you want to choose something, your choice.
Well, I've got one that's a little later. Let's try this. This is about a character named Zimbalist, the Boundary Maven. Zimbalist, the Boundary Maven, is small, frail, slope-shouldered, column 75, but looking 10 years older. Patchy, cinder-gray hair worn too long, sunken, dark eyes, and pale skin tinged yellow like a celery heart. He wears a zip cardigan with collar flaps and a pair of old plastic sandals, navy blue, over white socks with a hole for the left big toe and its horn. His herringbone trousers are stained with egg yolk, acid, tar, epoxy fixative, sealing wax, green paint, mastodon blood. The maven's face is bony, mostly nose and chin, evolved for noticing, probing, cutting straight to gaps, breaches, and lapses. His full, ashy beard flutters in the wind like bird fluff caught on a barbed wire fence. In 100 years of helplessness, this would be the last face that Lantzman would ever turn to, hoping for aid or information.
That paints an interesting picture. What's a boundary maven?
Well, the boundary maven is kind of a job I made up for this book. In strict observance of Judaism, there is an absolute prohibition on carrying on the Sabbath. You are not allowed to have anything in your pocket once you leave your house that could be construed as carrying. You can't walk your dog on a leash because that's mm-hmm. considered to be carrying. Mm-hmm. And so... Jews over the years, observant Jews, have very cleverly come up with a way of creating an indoor space outdoors by stringing up barriers of rope and string and using telephone wires on telephone poles and considering those to be walls and considering the space between two poles to be a door. And they say, okay, all of this that's encircled by these wires and ropes and strings going along this huge area, that's also indoor space, and therefore we can, you know, have a package of Tums in our pocket as we walk to temple on Friday night. And in my novel, there is a strong ultra-Orthodox community, and there are a lot of people wanting to know where they can carry and where they can't carry. Mm-hmm. And the Boundary Maven has sort of exploited this niche and has become the master who keeps all the maps and charts of where there is sacred space and where the space is profane and where you can walk and where you can't walk with a you know, some change in your pocket. And that has made him very powerful, because then he knows everything, in a sense, and his crews climb up these poles and they can look in windows, and he's kind of like a spider sitting at the center of a huge web, and therefore he's the one that the detectives go to when they need to get some information about this.
Very imaginative, and nice to know that even in the most orthodox reaches of religion, people find their ways to get creative with the rules.
I know. Well, that's one of the things I just I love about Judaism so much, is that there has been so much brilliance expended over the, you know, centuries on finding loopholes and ways around, so that on Passover, when all you're supposed to be eating is matzah, you know, that actually you can eat cakes and cookies.
That's right.
And all of these lavish
unleavened macaroons. Okay, we're going to continue with Michael Chabon. His new novel is The Yiddish Policeman's Union. It is available as a thank you gift in our membership drive for a $120 pledge. We hope you will call to support WNYC and take advantage of that if you're interested in the book at 1-888-376-WNYC, 1-888-376-9692, or pledge online at WNYC.org. More Michael Chabon coming up, including another reading. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we do continue now with author Michael Chabon, whose latest book is The Yiddish Policeman's Union, which, if you're just joining us, is a detective mystery set in the historical alternative, or the alternate history of what if this plan that was kicking around Washington in the 1940s had actually come to pass, where instead of Israel, the United States had set up a homeland for the Jews fleeing Europe in Alaska. So, Michael, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian.
And you're going to read something for us that, sets up your main character?
Yes, the protagonist of the novel is a guy named Meyer Lantzman. He's a homicide detective for the Sitka Police Department. According to doctors, therapists, and his ex-wife, Lantzman drinks to medicate himself, tuning the tubes and crystals of his moods with a crude hammer of 100-proof plum brandy. But the truth is that Lantzman has only two moods, working and dead. Meyer Lantzman is the most decorated shamus in the district of Sitka, the man who solved the murder of the beautiful Fruma Lefkowitz by her furrier husband, and caught Podolsky, the hospital killer. His testimony sent Hyman Charney to federal prison for life, the first and last time that criminal charges against a Verbover wise guy have ever been made to stick. He has the memory of a convict, the balls of a fireman, and the eyesight of a housebreaker. When there is crime to fight, Lantzman tears around Sitka like a man with his pant leg caught on a rocket. It's like there's a film score playing behind him, heavy on the castanets. The problem comes in the hours when he isn't working, when his thoughts start blowing out the open window of his brain like pages from a blotter. Sometimes it takes a heavy paperweight to pin them down.
So you've got alternative Jewish history, and you've got, from the sound of the words there and the sound of the way you read them, some 1940s noir.
It's hard to avoid that kind of Philip Marlowe tone when you're reading that. Yes, and I am heavily influenced by Raymond Chandler, both in this book, by his writing, I mean, in this book, and in a lot of my writing. He's one of my favorite writers, and I love Ross MacDonald too, and Dashiell Hammett, of course.
Yeah, and the detective, the character Meyer Lantzman, his name is a bit of a Yiddishism, isn't it?
Yeah, Lantzman is a word that means townsman or countryman or somebody who comes from the same place that you do, your fellow resident of wherever it is you come from. And then that, by broader implication, it just means a fellow Jew. And so in a sense, it's a word like, it's almost like every Jew.
I'm curious what you think, having written this alternate history where instead of Israel, Jews from Europe go to Alaska after World War II. What changes and what doesn't? I mean, in the book, there's still a big division between the secular and observant, between the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox. There's still conflict with the neighbors. Here are the Native Americans instead of the Palestinians.
Right.
So what changes and what remains the same as you imagine this alternate history?
Well, I mean, you're right. That part of what you see in this crazy mirror that I'm holding up to the world that we live in is how much has not changed, and how much there seem to be these patterns of Jewish life that, regardless of the circumstances, the outcome is in some ways the same or similar, and then in all those ways that you just mentioned. And I mean, it's just impossible for me, at least, to conceive of a community of Jews living together in fairly close quarters who aren't, you know, subject to all kinds of fractures and fissions and divisions among them. In a way, that's sort of what Jews are famous for. There's a classic joke about the guy who is trapped alone on a desert island, a Jew, and, you know, he builds two synagogues in his spare time just so he can have one to hate. But, you know, on the other hand, the big difference, and I think it is a big difference in this world, is that there is no Israel. There's no Jewish state in the Middle East, and that produces all kinds of differences, both for the region itself and for the Jews. You know, the Jews in my novel find themselves in this situation that up until 1948 had been sort of the classic characteristic situation for the Jews. That is, they are facing expulsion. And the territory of Alaska that they've been living in, the district that they've been living in, is about to revert to control by the state. And some of them may be permitted to stay. It's not clear, but many of them, almost most of them, are going to have to leave. And that kind of situation is one that, you know, has confronted the Jews from the beginning of their wanderings. But it's not one that we are really familiar with in the modern era. And certainly it's not occurred in a modern post-war context,
right? Well,
on the scale that it's going to be occurring here.
Another piece of the history here that's really alternative is that instead of Hebrew, which of course is the official language of Israel, Yiddish becomes the official language of this Jewish community in Alaska. And the reviewer in the foreword saw a big significance in that, seeing a shift from a Hebrew-speaking warrior not tied to recent history and the Yiddish-speaking chess players still anchored by language to the shtetls, the old neighborhoods. Is that fair, or does it take it too far?
No, I think that's fair. And I mean, I think in a way part of the reason, there's absolutely no doubt that Yiddish carries this all of this weight and baggage, if you want to call it that, or if you want to call it just a rich heritage of associations from the past, and it's a ghetto past. It's a past of living in shtetls and ghettos, and it was absolutely one of the reasons why the people that wanted to get rid of Yiddish and substitute Hebrew in its place for the Jews of Palestine and what became Israel, that was the reason they wanted to get rid of it, because it did have all of those associations with a past. It was a past that they were all too eager to forget. It was a past that was for them filled with shame and embarrassment. You know, I think my own family, there was a certain amount of that. My grandparents and great-grandparents spoke Yiddish, and they loved speaking Yiddish. But on the other hand, there was this ambivalence, and they also felt like it was something that was holding, that would hold them back, or that would certainly hold their children back. That was not anything they saw any value in passing on or preserving. They didn't mind it for themselves, but it did have this sort of legacy of associations with failure and shame.
Are you fluent in Yiddish?
No, not even close.
Did you go back and study it at all for?
Yeah, I
this
tried
book?
To educate myself. I taught myself how to read it. I can read it with a dictionary. I know more than I ever did before I started writing the book, but I don't have any. Mm-hmm. I don't think I have any hope of ever learning how to.
Were your own parents in that pattern of those who spoke it but decided not to pass it on?
My parents weren't really given the opportunity to learn it by their parents. It was my grandparents and the generation before them mm-hmm. that were the ones who abandoned the language or put it aside and decided it was, you know, you had to speak English. It was important to be American. And just like, you know, every immigrant group before and since.
My guest on WNYC, the novelist Michael Chabon, who won the Pulitzer Prize for The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier in Clay. In 2001, he also wrote Wonder Boys. You may remember his new one is The Yiddish Policeman's Union. And it is, if you're just tuning in, one of the thank you gifts in our membership drive. For a $120 pledge, we'll send you as a thank you gift a copy of The Yiddish Policeman's Union. Call 1-888-376-WNYC. If you're interested, 1-888-376-9692. Or pledge online at WNYC.org, a great way to support the radio station and get a great new novel in the bargain. Michael, the New York Post tried to stir up a little trouble for you recently, writing that the book is, quote, bound to set off a firestorm of controversy. And I guess that was for your depiction of the ultra-Orthodox sect that you call Verbovers in the book, mm-hmm. who bear a certain resemblance to the real-world Lubavitchers.
No, they really don't, actually. I think that was pretty grossly inaccurate. And anybody who knows anything about the Lubavitchers and reads my novel will see that there's almost no similarities between them whatsoever. I mean, the Lubavitchers are very outward-reaching, modern form of Hasidism. The Verbovers in my novel are intensely clannish. They completely keep to themselves. They have no interest in the outside world whatsoever. Furthermore, they're criminal organizations. It almost seemed to me like it was, I would say it was kind of anti-Semitic to even look at these.
So some people made that connection, trying to make you controversial. Perhaps.
I guess so. It's really hard to understand, and particularly because it turned out the person who was the source of this story for the Post then went on to write a really favorable review of the book in People magazine. So I'm confused by the whole thing. Maybe you can explain it to me.
I don't think I can. But before we run out of time, you've also gotten some attention for your public support for Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama. Your wife, who some people may know is the writer Ayelet Waldman, went, which is my mother's maiden name, by the way, went to law school with him. And
you were Lantzman.
Oh, what?
You and I.
Lantzman?
Yeah, we're Lantzman, if that's your wife's maiden name.
My mother's, yeah.
Oh, your mother's.
Together, you sent out a fundraising email to your friends that got picked up by Gawker and various other media outlets.
That was funny.
Right? So you wrote, have you ever voted for a presidential candidate you felt was truly worthy of office, a candidate whose ideas seemed tested by a genuine curiosity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Want to talk about that?
Sure. I'm completely behind Barack Obama. I honestly don't feel like I've ever even seen a candidate like him in my lifetime. And I've been waiting a long time. I voted for the first time in 1984, and I've never voted for a candidate for president, even in the primary or the general election, that I was wholeheartedly enthusiastic
and
about.
So reading through these list of qualities in your fundraising email, a candidate who tries to see beyond the confines of received ideas, a candidate whose dynamism and charisma are in service not merely to his own yawning vanity but to talent and aptitude, I mean, all those things are qualities of the person as opposed to stands on issues.
Well, I almost take his stands on issues for granted. He seems to me like a pretty much a straightforward liberal kind of candidate. I think his positions on most of the issues are ones that I agree with. And I've had that before. I've voted for candidates whose positions were in line with my own beliefs. That's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking to be able to vote for somebody that I think actually has arrived at those positions through a process of thought and reasoning mm-hmm. that I see as being informed by knowledge of American history, by knowledge of the way the world works.
So in our last 30 seconds, is there a connection between your writing, the heart-wrenching with the funny, the ideas with the pulp, and your support for Obama, because you write that he understands the bleak and heartening realities of American life, bleak and heartening.
Yeah, I mean, he has that grasp of ambivalence, of ambiguity, that things are not black and white, that things are gray, and that it's okay for things to be gray, that is the way the world is, and that you can live in the gray middle like everybody else in the world and make your way in that gray middle and not have to stake out a position that is artificially favoring one extreme over the other. That's just not the way life works, and everybody else lives in the middle. I don't know why our leaders can't as well.
And reflective of the book, The Yiddish Policeman's Union by Michael Chabon. It's been so much fun to talk to you. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate it.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we will continue our week-long series with quick looks at various forms of transportation other than the car in the New York City area. Today, it's the trains. But remember, it's our spring membership drive, and we do have copies of Michael Chabon's book, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, available as a thank you gift. For those of you who want to pledge $120 to make that contribution, call 1-888-376-WNYC, 1-888-376-9692, or pledge online at WNYC.org. For the book or otherwise, thank you, everybody, for your support. We really appreciate it.